also the cooling lines, duct lines, that's all disconnected automatically, and it's a docking system. But a berthing system, it's manually done, except for the bolts that they were, like you said, they're all separated electrically. John, over here.
May I ask a further question, Dick?
If you send us a big enough check, good, John.
Yeah, it's in the mail. Paul, 16,000. Okay, now is that 16,000 foot-pounds of torque per bolt, or is that the tensile strength of the bolt? That's an awful lot of foot-pounds.
Yeah, I'm always trying to confirm that. I've gone to a lot of different websites and interviews. You know, you had people talking, and I even heard some guys say that years ago. Wow, it sounds like it's a big number to me. So someday I'd like to really confirm it. I'd like to have an interview with these guys. You know, I mean, it's amazing that, you know, they have this whole docking set up and it pulls themselves together. Well, they don't do 16,000 pounds with the manned spacecraft, but they do it with the berthing system. But, you know, both of them, you know, they pull themselves together, and then they're able to pull the centerpiece in with it. Like, for instance, on the Soyuz spacecraft, it's all hinged, that all disconnects, that whole setup, they hinge it in, they're able to go through the same opening. And I've got close-ups of pictures, and I'd really like to see how that's done. Now, in the old days, they used to be like a male and female type of setup. You had two spacecraft, like when they went up with Gemini and they were docking with the Gina, you know, the Gina would be able to dock with Gemini, no problem, drop it. But if you had two Gemini spacecrafts up there, you know, you'd have like two male ends, you know, it just wouldn't work. But nowadays, Russians started with this, they have this androgynous system. So, you know, I mean, for instance, if you had a spacecraft that was stranded up there, you could send another, you know, space shuttle up or something to dock with it. You know, they wouldn't have to worry about, you know, does this thing have a male and a female? It doesn't matter on the newer systems. And that includes the new NASA docking system that SpaceX is going to be ringing up on field day, Sunday. John, over here.
Very good, Paul. Well, as you and I know, I believe those would have to be Acme threads with that kind of torque. But let me kick it back to Dick. And by the way, Dick, when you're finished, I just have one quick question for Paul later. But you go on. KC2, BGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me hear a little bit more about this 16,000 pounds. When you bring two spacecraft together at the docking, when you bring a spacecraft to the International Space Station, and it goes to the 31-inch diameter docking port, or if it's a larger object and you bring it to the 50-inch wide berthing port, you first have this drogue device that a male and female sticks together to draw the two spacecraft together and hopefully creates great alignment. After that, some other method of attachment has to take place because the air pressure inside builds up real fast, gets some huge pounds of force by trying to separate these two objects in space because of the vacuum outside and the air pressure inside. You probably told us a couple of times, but I forgot. Does the International Space Station run at 5 pounds, 10 pounds, or 15 pounds per square inch as the average pressure is question number one? And there's 16,000 pounds. Are these the bolts around the perimeter of either the docking port or the berthing port that hold the two objects together? What is 16,000 pounds of torque doing? I missed something on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, well, it has to do with the berthing system, the cargo, the spacecraft that bolt to one another. In some cases, also parts of the International Space Station, for instance. They just took the one module last week, and they disconnected a multi-purpose module. They disconnected from the one port, and they put it into a completely different port. Well, that was all on birth and rebirth. And then that has these 16 bolts. And, you know, after they dock, they have this camera, apparently they call it the center line camera, that sits in on one side. And these things, they align themselves, and these bolts must catch. I mean, I can see the bolt holes on it, you know, close up. The holes, I can't see the bolts, I haven't seen the bolts yet. But apparently these things are a ton with motors, and which I can't see. And that's what's driven together, apparently, with the 16,000 pound PSI. That's why I can't confirm. I mean, I've seen it on a number of websites, but that doesn't mean, you know, I've got to confirm. Well, somebody tells me that, you know, preferably from NASA. But it's tremendous torque that they use. That's number one. Number two, the docking system. Yeah, they have this drogue thing that goes in and line themselves up. They call that a soft dock. And then these latching things, latch around this ring. Those latching mechanisms apparently are also on some kind of electrically driven rods, and they pull themselves together. And the shock absorber is involved, so that, you know, any kind of strain that occurs with the soft dock is taken out. And after these things retract, the two rings pull against each other, and then now you have your 31 inch port that you can go through. They have that with the this module, what do you call that, permanent this offset module. They have like 2 and 3. There's 3 of them on the space station. One of them, the first one, connects the Russians with the American side, the Russian Zarya module. That was the first one that was sent up back in 1999 with the Unity module. So anytime the Russians go from the Russian side to the American side, they have to go through this 31-inch diameter hole. But all the other connections for the American side on these 50-inch doors. You see that when you're looking at an interview, 50-inch wide door. And that door is surrounded by an even bigger, like probably 56-inch diameter ring. And that's the ring that has these 16 bolts that drive themselves tight. And the pressure deck is pressure inside the space station is 14.7 pounds absolute, and what we have here on Earth, and nitrogen and oxygen is the same proportion that we have on right here on Earth. So that makes it nice anyway. When you dock with the space shuttle, that docking area, they used to use that almost like a secondary room. They would close it off. They have that on the space station. That's called Quest. There's a whole section of the space station called Quest that you can separate from the other part of the space station. So you can put a couple guys in there, and you gradually lower the pressure in there over time, and not affect the rest of the crewmates. good, Dick, because eventually when you do a spacewalk, I think you're down to around 3 pounds now. A little over 3 pounds of pure oxygen.
Yeah, I can sort of see why, because the amount of pressure of oxygen is what counts. Oxygen is roughly 20% of our atmosphere. So one-fifth of 14, let's call it 15 pounds, is 3 pounds. So 3 1/2 pounds of pure oxygen makes the body think that they're getting the right amount of oxygen, although there's some strong disadvantages of running at low air pressure for an extended period of time. That birthing object at 50 inches square is 25,000 square inches at 15 pounds per square inch. That adds up to 37,500 pounds of total pressure trying to separate the two objects. Well, the ring outside of the 50-inch birthing is actually larger. So I imagine the total force between the two is more like 45,000 pounds. It gives me some idea as to why these really strong bolts are required. Air pressure builds up kind of fast. And water pressure builds up very fast when your car goes in the water and the water starts rising against the door and you think you're going to open the door. So anybody who's in an automobile that's going near water, prepared to swim out the window is the only way you're going to exit that car. John, I know you had a further question. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
VH1RY.
We're going to go to John and Joe in that area. Go ahead, John. That area. That order. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Paul, if you know, last night I was in a conversation about this thing that is called Planet X. Supposed to be recognized by NASA. I don't know if they have, and it's supposed to have an incursion with our orbit, supposedly this September. Have you heard anything about it? Ever read anything about this planet? It seems that it might be giving us a cause for concern, but nobody's paying attention to it. So what's going on, if you know? In case you do know, you mean. Back to you, Paul.
No, I can't help you with that. I mean, there was always years ago, you're going back in decades, I'm sure you remember, they always said there had to be a Planet X out there, and they searched for it and searched for it. Couldn't find it. And then they said there's a planet Vulcan, and just before Star Trek, they called it Planet Vulcan, and it had to be a planet on the exact opposite side of the sun. We just can't see it, you know. Of course, all that's been dismissed, you know, with all our spacecraft blowing out. We've had spacecraft go actually over the sun, right over the northern and southern poles of the sun. And that was called Ulysses. And that was a joint ESA and American flight. They kind of proved there was nothing on the other side of the sun years ago. But now we have, of course, Stereo, the two spacecraft that are, I mean, they're out there like probably 90 degrees by now outside the relationship to the Earth. You know, one's following and one's leading. But I know, John, haven't heard about this. I'll have to look up the new Planet X. Back to you, John.
Very good, Paul. Yeah, and it was claimed to have been on the NASA website, so I thought you would have seen it. Well, don't worry too much about it. If you have to, let me know what's going on. Dick, back to you, sir. KC2WGB.
And Dick, do you ever see these PMA contraptions I was talking about that are attached to the space station?
I haven't. I'm going to go look for them. The PMA device. Give me a quick description. But before you do that, let's pick up Joe first. W-H-Y-Y-Y. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening. This is the interesting subject you're talking about. But what I've always thought about, when you have these two spacecraft join each other like this, and I realize there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the area that's actually looking at the outside area of space, which is zero, no pressure, compared to what's inside. What material actually joins the two spacecraft where they actually touch each other? Is it some sort of rubber bumper or something like that, or is it just simply a steel-to-steel contact, which can keep all the air in and keep the vacuum from getting in? Back to you.
You got it, Paul.
some kind of, I mean, it's very fine steel when you look at it. It's base, you know, there's no gasket or anything, so maybe there's some kind of alloy steel that, you know, part of that basing. It might compress a little bit, I can't imagine it, but yeah, you don't see any gasket-like base on these things when you bring, you know, close-up views. But yeah, I really don't know for sure. I thought about that quite a bit. I know there's no O-rings or anything. You know, there are when it comes to some of the merging processes that they've used. They have done that, but still, even with that, you know, whatever it's, you know, facing up one to another, I don't know, you think there would be some kind of graphite or something in between, but I just don't see it when you look at it close. Like I said, it's hard to confirm these things. Even the 16,000 pound talk, I've read it in a number of places, so it's probably true, but you can't confirm it. And just like what I was going to bring up to Dick, the PMA, pressure mating adapters, they call them, three on board the space station.
Sounds like DPC connectors.
I don't know. Years on and off, looking at different books and magazines, internet, websites, to try to pin down, you know, why they have this the way they look. They're black-looking things. The purpose of it is to connect to a berthing port. For instance, you have these nodes all over, three nodes on the space station. And out of the node, you might have six ports. You know, one side you have a big cylinder going in, maybe it's called Destiny, and the other side on a run is another cylinder, another node called Harmony, and then coming out of the other one, out of another port, you might have the Columbus module. These things are all burned together. You know, you eventually have to make one of these connections connect to something that a space shuttle could dock to. So they have the PMA, pressure mating adapter. And one side has got this 56-inch, like, diameter thing that attaches to the berthing side. And then the other side has inside diameter of 31 inches. Somebody can go through from one side to the other when you're docking. That side was a lot smaller. And you wonder why in the world they look the way they do. It's got this 20 degree offset when you look at it. You know, I mean, on the run, it's running parallel, but it has this offset. You know, in other words, it breaks down and it breaks forward. And took me forever trying to figure out, you know, I knew it had to do with, you know, it was a better docking system for the shuttle, but it took me forever to figure out why. And finally, I did find something that explained it, why they have it look the way they do. And it turns out that when it was taking things out of the cargo bay with the robotic arm, you would have lost 2 feet. If it was straight on, you know, like a regular reducer, instead of this offset reducer, plus 2 feet, you know, instead of taking out a 28-foot diameter, 28-foot long, 14-foot diameter cylinder that you're going to attach to the space station for a new room, you would wind up having, you know, 2 foot shorter. Eliminates the problem. Now, on the end of this is going to be the new adapter, the NASA docking adapter. Dick, over to you, KTRIWWS.
The bolts that have these 16,000 pounds or foot-pounds of torque, any idea what the diameter of one of those bolts is in a pole?
I brought it up close. probably less than three quarter. I don't know. My guess is probably metric. I'm gonna call it. I'll call it three quarters. It's probably a touch less than that.
That don't sound right to me.
That sounds not much too big. Not much too much talk. It's got to be a bigger bolt than that, unless it's extremely high strength materials. The 130 foot high tower that was at the RCA site in Riverhead that I took apart a zillion years ago. It was all attached with 5,000 bolts that were 3/4 inch diameter, 10 threads per inch. And some of those bolts did require a very large wrench to get them to move. I think I was using a wrench that was close to 3 foot long and putting all my weight on it to get some of them to move. But that's a few hundred foot-pounds. 16,000 foot-pounds. I can't imagine that number. Yes, with an impact wrench, you can reach those kind of numbers. But with an ordinary wrench, a man standing at some reasonable distance applying force, that can't be done.
Oh. Off the top of my head, that bolt should be approximately 3 inches thick.
No way. That's where the 16,000 pound number would be wrong. And now these things are about no bigger than 3/4.
So the 16,000 pound number, was that called dying inches, dying centimeters, foot pounds, newton meters? Any idea what units would use their poles as?
Yeah, that's the thing I found. Pounds of force, you know, to me, they're probably talking about foot pounds. You gotta watch what you read, you know, just like a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the diameter of the planets, you know. For some reason, they love to give things now. They don't give you the diameter of planets when you look something up on the internet. Not like my old books. Everything's a radius. So I don't care about the radius of these things, but that's what they give you now. Do you know it's, how many Earth radii this is? Why did you say diameter? You know, I don't get it. I never even got one with 2 pi r. You know, just call it d pi and then be done with it.
I'm going to guess that the 16,000 pounds of force is total tension on the bolt. A 3/4 inch bolt can easily take 16,000 pounds of force. I mean, just construction steel, I think it's got a yield number of 50,000 pounds per square inch. And there are some exotic steels and alloys that'll go to numbers like 130,000 pounds per square inch. So I'm going to guess that that's total force of tension on the bolt. What do you think, John? KT2WGB, KT2RIW?
I'll agree with you, Dick. It's either that or the tensile strength, the capability of the bolt. So maybe they torque it up near that amount, but it's not near the breaking part of the bolt, which would be maybe 16,000 pounds. But that can't be the foot-pounds on that bolt. That I know, unless they got some material I'm not aware of.
That's right. They say 16,000 pounds of force. They don't say foot-pounds. That's so you're probably right there.
Yeah, that sounds like tension. A similar situation occurred on Apollo 16. I remember listening to the astronauts while I'm recording on that homebrew equipment. And Mattingly, Young, and Duke, I forget which one of them was unhappy about the fact that the command module and the lunar module, when they had docked, the docking mechanism, which was a bunch of chocks, they call them finger-like things, that clamped down between the two vehicles. Two or three of those hadn't seated properly. And I think it was Mattingly was unhappy about that. And so he was telling the ground that he was about to operate this manual handle in order to loosen those devices in order to get them to seat properly. And you can see that if things didn't go right, the two vehicles would blast apart because of the huge amount of air pressure, which maybe they were not considering correctly. And they'd be in instant vacuum. They weren't wearing spacesuits, so it would have been game over. So in no uncertain terms, Houston then told him, please leave that lever alone. Don't touch it. Another subject was that a couple of weeks ago, Vito to be to PJF, which is the process of reworking or replacing the traps on his tri-band beam. And when he sees the latest issue of QST, the July 2015 issue, on page 39, there's a very nice article about repair and restore your Mosley beam. They show you a cutaway picture. Let me drop this. They show you a cutaway picture of what's inside that trap. They give you methods of homebrewing yourself another trap if the one you've got is sufficiently corroded and you don't want to buy the expensive item from the factory and you want to build your own. So lots of good information there about restoring Mosley beams. One other thing I was going to mention to you guys last week or the week before is this crazy situation going on in Berkeley, California with reference to cell sites. I'm going to read this one to you. Stand by.
Did you see the vector network analyzed on page 60 in the same book?
I think I did. This is the one by Paul Wade. He's very good at finding inexpensive pieces of test equipment. Oh, no. Okay, that's a cute. Yes, that is by Paul Wade. That's a Paul Wade article. There's this device you can buy where you use your cell phone as a display device to picture network analysis, spectrum analyzer. That's the one you're talking about, the Paul Wade article. W1, let's see what his call it is. That's from microwave. 6150. And there it is. Good old Paul. It's W1 gigahertz, W1 GHz. So I think that's the article you're referring to. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
I saw it, I know you talk about the Beckman network analyzer quite a bit, and this thing is supposed to be for $560, and it's 2% of the cost of a real one. So fascinating. Yeah, I mean, it was only one paragraph about that topic on page 60. So I mean, you know, how expensive are these things? If this is $560 and it's 2% of the cost of a commercial version, wow.
That means the commercial version is around $25,000. Nowadays, vector network analyzers, spectrum analyzers are not quite that bad, but yes, they are very expensive. What's really going on here is that when I first cut my teeth in the engineering world, and you wanted to test something, let's say for instance you've got an amplifier and you want to test it, you want to measure a frequency plot, and hopefully not a phase plot, because in those days it was very difficult. You started up with a signal generator. You didn't quite believe the frequency dial on the signal generator, so you also have a frequency meter. So signal generator, frequency meter, some kind of a power sensing device, maybe a directional coupler into a power meter. Then that signal was being fed maybe through another directional coupler, looking at reflected signal from your amplifier. Then your amplifier, the output of the amplifier then went into some kind of a power sensing device and or a phase sensing device. So every time you want to test something like an amplifier or a filter, you're assembling all of these pieces of test equipment over and over again. Let me drop. So somewhere around 1970 or so, somebody said, gee, we're doing the same process over and over again. Why don't we combine all of those into one cabinet? Signal generator, frequency counter, directional coupler, power meter. And when you do that, you've got what's now called a vector network analyzer. Then it was called a combined test set or something like that. I forget what name they gave it in the beginning. But over and over again, we were always setting up, gathering the same pieces of equipment, putting them on a bench in order to do a test. So we've come a long way. And in those days, to make a frequency plot of, say, an amplifier with standing wave ratio, that was a man's day's worth of work. Nowadays, you hook up your amplifier to an already calibrated vector network analyzer, and across the whole frequency spectrum, the standing wave ratio and the gain is plotted in a fraction of a second, and the plot on the screen is updated every 30 milliseconds. So if there's any tuning controls inside the amplifier that you want to adjust to get the flattest possible response, the highest possible gain, or the lowest possible input standing wave ratio, or anything along those lines. To see it on a modern-day vector network time. You could do that alignment in a couple of minutes. Can you imagine the old days where you could only see one frequency at a time, and you made your measurements and then switched to another frequency, and you put another dot on the chart, if you know what I mean, to adjust controls inside of an amplifier in the old days. Took you an awful long period of time. Let me drop. I'm hearing some funny extra noises coming out of my transmitter. I have to inspect that one of these days real soon. What's going on in Berkeley? This article appeared in the June 10th issue of Electronic Component News. Here's what's going on in Berkeley. Berkeley city officials passed the so-called right-to-know ordinance in May. The law requires electronic retailers to post warnings that read, quote, if you carry or use your phone in pants or shirt pocket, or tuck into the bra, when your phone is on and connected to a wireless network, you may exceed the federal guidelines for exposure to RF radiation. This potential risk is greater for children. Refer to the instructions in your phone or user's manual for information about how to use your phone safely. That was being ordered by the city of Berkeley, California, that it must be included as a warning with every cell phone they sold.
When you get a chance, Rich, UPS is on and calling for you.
Okay, before I proceed, let's pick up Rich right now. K2UPS, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick and John. I was trying to get in a little bit earlier, but I lost the signal and stuff. After you're done discussing this Berkeley stuff, I just wonder, I had sent both you and John an article about a 3D printer project over in, I think it was in Holland, where they mated up the computer parts of the 3D printer with welding machines, and autonomously, one on each side of a canal in over a canal in Holland, they're going to build a bridge completely by 3D printer and robot. Steel bridge. I just didn't know if you had gotten a chance to see that.
I saw it. Great stuff. They just haven't picked the canal. Dick, over to you.
I saw it as well. Thank you, Rich.
You know, what's unique about that thing, as I remember, Rich, is that it literally starts from one shore and builds a bridge as a cantilever hanging out into space. It isn't clear whether or not they built it all the way from one side. I presume they built one half from each side and eventually join it in the middle. But this thing constructs a steel structure sufficiently strong that the first half of the bridge, so to speak, hangs from one shore, hangs out into empty space above the river. That's the picture that I remember seeing. Back to you for some updates on that, Rich. KTUPS in Pennsylvania, Mobile. KTURIW in the TechNet.
That's correct, Dick. And they were going to have, I think they talked about having four machines, two on each side, but then they discussed that there was really only going to be two, starting at the same time and then meeting up in the middle, but each half could basically stand on its own, but then they would eventually be joined in the middle. Pretty cool stuff. I had not seen anything like that before, which is why I forwarded that on, so, and I didn't know if it had been discussed, but I was just curious if you saw it or not. I know you guys get a lot of email. But thanks for taking a look at that K2UPS back in it.
Yeah, glad you mailed that to us. Now, a subject I did want to ask you about, Rich, is Google, among other people, are experimenting with thoroughly automatic vehicles, driverless vehicles, that in theory are going to be safer as long as they can properly recognize a pedestrian in front of them, not running over. And I think there's also been equal talk about an automatic driver for vehicles like yours. I wonder, has there been very much talk along those lines about automating what you're doing? Over to you, Rich. KTUPS, K2RIW, and the TechNet. I'd like to believe that's at least 10 years away.
It's actually here today, Dick. In the United States, there is a fully autonomous truck, heavy-duty tractor-trailer on the roads right now. I believe it is out in Nevada, Fitzgerald to Nevada. Now, there is a driver on board, but he is there very similar to a pilot on board many modern planes, just in case something goes wrong. But the truck knows where it is. It can drive through city traffic. It can drive on the interstate. He's still sitting there, and he can take over if necessary, but the truck has enough sensors on it, cameras, and all sorts of other stuff that it can maneuver around things and through things completely on its own. So that technology is here, and it is in use today. Widespread use of that, I think, is still far away. It's not going to replace the drivers, because I don't think any company is going to risk putting a machine on the road like that without somebody there, but supposedly it's going to save companies a lot of money in the long run, insurance-wise. That remains to be seen. Back to you, Dick.
I guess I'm going to call that driver-assisted vehicle. In other words, many of the decisions of properly propelling or steering or guiding the vehicle at the right velocity, in the right direction, at the right time, is being done by the machine. And in theory, the machine has essentially no fatigue, doesn't fall asleep, doesn't get its attention diverted, in theory. A man there is as a backup. So I think you're saying that the main intention is not to replace the driver, but to do something that's going to have an even lower accident rate than the human driver. Is that the main intention right now from your point of view, Rich?
Yes, I believe, and this is coming from the company that's producing it, and I can't remember offhand who it was, but I think Benz is involved to some extent. I'm trying to remember what it was now. I have to look up that article again. But the main thing is that, yes, it's going to be, it's an expensive system to put in, but you'll save more than that in insurance premiums because these trucks supposedly are incapable of causing an accident. Not to say that if something jumps in front of faster than it can put the brakes on, yes, it's probably going to hit it. The stimulus that might divert a driver's attention and maybe cause an accident, like you said, getting tired, the thing doesn't get tired, that's all going to go away. So I guess if they can convince the insurance companies that look how safe this thing is, it might come out. But there is one, like I said, right now on the roads. It came out, a few months ago. I saw that. I was pretty shocked to see it myself back then.
There was somebody who recently requested by Freedom of Information Act data that had been gathered in some of the Google experiments. The fact that there were some accidents that occurred with the automatic vehicle that Google uses to do street view gathering. And apparently there were very minor accidents, and I believe the semi-second, trying to find them on my radio is making noises. The vehicle was not at fault, but still, even a minor fender bender that occurs with an automatically operated vehicle is going to make some people a little bit alarmed. And can it recognize all possible hazards? It's a darn interesting question. There have been competitions that have held out in, I think, California, in the desert areas, of vehicles that automatically drive a particular course, and it's a competition between the various vendors. I think that's been going on for a number of years. Now, getting back to Berkeley under ordinarily is a very moderate college. I would call it a very moderate town. But for the town fathers to come up with this warning that should be put on cell phones is obviously excessive. The Berkeley councilman, Mr. Worthington, describes the intent that was used, the singular only thing in which we legislate here today is on the consumer's right to know. We are not telling the consumer what to do. Okay, the CTIA, the Wireless Association, announced on June 8th that it will seek legal remedy to strike down this ordinance. And the CTIA said that the consumer warning requires retailers to make unsubstantiated and false statements about the alleged effects of cell phones, which would contradict the findings from independent health and scientific organizations. Three drops. The FCC states and confirmed its confidence that the conservative health and safety standards for cell phones fully protect public health. The leading global health organizations, such as the American Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, the World Health Organization, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, all concur that wireless devices are not a public health risk. Theodore Olson, from the law firm of Gibson and Dunn, which represents the CIA, said the ordinance plainly violates the First Amendment. The ordinance also unlawfully interferes with FCC regulations and contradicts the federal government's determination based on extensive scientific evidence that cell phones approved for sale in the United States do not pose a public health risk. Let me jump. Olson, that attorney, also said it is unconstitutional to force cell phone retailers to communicate false, misleading, and inflammatory information about their products. It's unfortunate that Berkeley would incite such a situation. Okay. One of the replies to this article, a real good comedian, said that there's one logical course of action. They should turn off all the cell towers within range of Berkeley. Everybody in the comments, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Their determination on that, was it may cause, or they're saying it does cause? How was that worded?
Okay, the Berkeley town, I guess, city, said that this exact statement must be implied. The exact statement is, if you carry or use your cell phone in a pants or shirt pocket or tucked into a bra, when the phone is on and connected to a wireless network, you may exceed the federal guidelines for exposure to RF radiation. This potential risk is greater for children. Refer to the instructions in your phone or user manual for information about how to use your phone safely. That's the exact statement that Berkeley was forcing the vendors in that town to issue with each cell phone that they sell. Craziness. I can see what their intent is, but it really is misleading. Once again, it's one of these situations where the word RF radiation is being strongly confused with other things like nuclear radiation. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I was just wondering. So they did say may. They should change the child reference to may also. That's just, forewarning people that it's possible. They're not saying definitely. So I don't see anything wrong with that statement. It's kind of silly, but I think they'll get away with it.
WHYY for K2RIW.
Yeah, the lawyers for the CTIA are in the process of getting that struck down. From their point of view, they're in violation of federal law to force that statement to be there. WHYY, K2RIW, you worked in the cell phone industry. How dangerous is it, Joe? That's a funny question. You know it. You got a joke.
Look at his condition.
Funny guy. I don't know. I've used cell phones for years when I was working in that industry. The only dangerous condition is using it while you're driving and having your mind concentrated more on the cell phone than you're driving. That's the only issue I really would say that is something you got to really think about, you know. But and the phone I use most of the time was at least one company's a 1-watt GSM phone, well, even though it's digital, so, you know. But I don't use the phone like, you know, continuously. But some of these people go a little crazy with this stuff. But then again, you know, it's just some of these people are going to, you know, come up with. They think it's a danger, so they're putting this, message out there. And you check your email for next week's subject that I'm going to bring up. Back to you.
Okay, I will do that, Joe. And I know you've mailed me a nice email recently with three attachments, but I'm unable to open those attachments. My crazy Linux system is rather restrictive. My son has set it up with such an ironclad firewall system. He's very strongly concerned about anything getting into our system that shouldn't be there. All this hacking you're hearing about these days is not necessarily what he's addressing, but as you know, a fair amount of violation of people's personal rights have taken place. This was TechNet number 1561 of the series, and that was Space Report number 154. We'll be back next week, it says here, with one digit higher number on each one of those, and look out for those RF waves. Speak to them with soft, soothing tones, and when it comes to your transmitter, make sure you feed it nothing but cookies and milk, and treat it nicely. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, clear but listening.
KC2WGB, very good. Well, I want to thank you, Dick and Paul. Great TechNet, and like you say, if all goes well, we'll be back with some more questions and even some answers next week. And we're going to solve all of these issues. And I'm interested to know what Joe wants, but I guess I'll have to wait. KC2WGB. Have fun, guys. KC2WGB, clear.
K2RW from WB2GXM.
Mr. GXM, go right ahead.
Dick, I'm still very interested and excited by the CCD antenna. I was going to send you a PDF file with the articles from Sony 3 Magazine, but it's 4.5 megabytes, so I thought I should ask you first. Would you like me to send it to you?
Yes, I would. I can tolerate either 10 or 20 megabytes per individual attachment, so size is not a problem. And particularly PDF, that's also the most universal thing in the world, so I'll be able to see it just exactly the way it was. Back to you, sir.
Good, Dick. Thank you. I will do it tomorrow. WB2GXM out.
And Dick, I just sent you two YouTube videos about that autonomous truck in Nevada, K2UPS.
Okay, thank you, Rich. And it doesn't sound like you're very worried about it yet. And it sounds to me like there's going to be required a human being on board for liability risk reasons. As such, it sounds to me like insurance will go down, the accident rate will go down, but the number of employees like you will stay the same. That's the way I see it. Rich, go ahead.
Are these things connected to the internet, and if so, are these things hacked?
I would imagine they're connected somehow, and I don't think anything is hack-proof, which is another reason why I feel fairly safe. My job isn't going away. Plus, being a union job, the union is not going to let this happen to our job too quickly. Private companies, another story. But I think by the time this really starts getting nasty, I'll be long retired, hopefully. I like that idea. I could be sitting home in my medium chair in the living room, right? And getting paid? Oh, I like that idea a lot. Thanks, John. You too. KTUB in Mobile, Pennsylvania.
exiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Warning, the time is 1:14 a.m. Thank you. the W2VL repeater. Amateur radio repeater system.